Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm privileged to welcome a very senior professional from the world of academia, from New York, USA, Professor Rita McGrath, PhD. Professor McGrath, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. Rita is the professor at Columbia Business School. She's the founder of Valise. She's a best-selling author, and all of you know I'm always very partial to authors. Her most recent book is a book titled Seeing Around Corners, How to Spot Inflection Points in Business Before They Happen. And she's a well-known speaker and strategic advisor. So Rita, before we talk strategy and your book, tell me about your own journey in brief and what led you to specialize in strategy and innovation.
Well, that was not the original idea. Okay. So many people's careers, I'm sure, have been described for you. You know, where you end up is almost never where you thought you would. So originally, I was going to go into public service. So I did a degree in political science and a master's in public administration, and then went and worked for the government for about 10 years.
Okay.
And then what I realized was, you know, in government careers, your career just skyrockets for the first 5 or 10 years, and then it's just, you know, a flat horizon from then on, pretty much. At the time, business schools were just exploding, you know, as finance became quite a force in many of the world's leading economies. The MBA degree became very desirable, and there was a big push to have people with PhDs actually in front of the MBAs. And so I decided to apply to business school as for a PhD, and got accepted at Wharton, where I found myself in the entrepreneurship center there. Okay. And that led to the leadership of a major 3-year study of corporate venturing at Citigroup. And that really opened the door to the whole idea of strategy and innovation and the study of strategy and innovation.
Wow. Amazing. Thank you. So let's talk about strategy for a few minutes, and then we'll come to your book. Let me start by asking you, since we have a very young audience, the word strategy has often been very misused and misconstrued. How do you, as an academic, define strategy in today's dynamic business environment?
Well, strategy to me has always been, you know, a single coherent view of how we're going to achieve our objectives. Mm-hmm. And each of those words really matters. So, you know, a shared view. So if I ask 3 people chosen at random from your organization, what's our strategy? I get back something that sounds vaguely consistent. Mm-hmm. It's a concept. So unlike many aspects of life, strategy has to be translated human mind to human mind. And it's really about the how, you know, how are we going to do this? And fundamentally, and you as a business person will appreciate this, you know, strategy is really about choices. Mm. And what I see a lot of people doing is not being willing to make choices. Mm. And, you know, if you've got competition and you've got limited resources, you can't do everything, right? You have to make some, in some cases, really tough choices about what you're going to pursue and whatnot. The other thing I think is a big mistake people make with strategy is they confuse strategy, which is the how, with the goal, which is the outcome you're trying to drive, right? And so I think it's really about choices under conditions of resource scarcity and competition.
You know, I love the way you've explained it so simply about strategy being the how and the goal being different. But for my viewers and listeners, can you give me an example where you have actually confronted this confusion of how and the goal?
You see it all the time. You know, our strategy is to become the largest market share provider. Our strategy is to, I literally have a client that has this strategy. Our strategy is to be the best investment our investors will ever make, the best employers our employees will ever have, and the best service provider our customers will ever encounter. And, you know, that's not a strategy. That doesn't tell you how. It doesn't guide action. And that's really the problem.
Great example. Thank you. So my next question is, how can organizations stay agile and adapt to rapid changes in their industries? Because that's also what drive strategy to a large extent?
Well, one of my previous books, not the most recent one, but one of my previous books called The End of Competitive Advantage actually digs into this. And I talk about needing a new playbook for strategy. And very briefly, it really talks about going from change being seen as this weird thing to change being something we need to embrace on a continuous basis. We need to get used to stopping things. So I call that healthy disengagement. We need to be better at putting our best resources against our best opportunities. And very often companies don't do that. Resources kind of get stuck and held hostage in divisions or legacy businesses. We need to get much more proficient at innovation. So not just getting ideas, but also incubating them and then allowing them to scale. Leadership needs to change. And this has been talked about a lot, but you know, I talk about discovery-driven leadership where leaders are simultaneously, you know, providing direction and guidance and clarity, but also open to new information, open to taking in ideas that may not have already been there. And finally, people, and this is particularly relevant for young people. You know, it used to be back in the day when things were more stable that you'd sign up with a company for life, you know, and you'd be with that company throughout a whole career and they would invest in your development and you would offer them loyalty. And that equation has really faded away. And what we're seeing now is what many people call the tour of duty. Employment situation where I sign up with a company for a while. I enjoy working with them for as long as it works for both of us. And then, you know, if I don't progress or see growth or go anywhere, I leave and maybe I'll be back, you know, but it's a whole different employer contract than we've seen before.
Great response. You know, and you're so right about this. You know, when I started work in 1979, you know, at last, you know, they joined this big multinational. These were referred to as the cradle to grave companies. You joined one and you stayed with until you die. You know? But I also made some lot of changes like you are saying are happening now. But my next question, Yurita, is how has the rise of technology affected or impacted traditional strategic planning?
Well, I think a couple of ways. The first is a dramatic reduction in cost of getting the basic analytical data that strategy relies on. You know, and if you look back in time, a lot of strategy groups were really analytical groups. You know, they were in charge of primarily M&A or something like that. And what technology has done is it's really collapsed the time and effort required to gather basic analytical data. I mean, back in the day, if you were Citibank and you wanted to know where to put a bank branch, right, you hired McKinsey and they had dozens and dozens of MBAs, you know, with clipboards counting passersby on the sidewalk, and that would tell you where your bank branch should be. Well, now you can access all that information at the click of a button. So what I think it's done is it's really made basic analytical information really easy to get. But at the same time, what that also does is it puts the premium on judgment and insight and pattern recognition and seeing beyond the first order effects to what might be the unexpected or unanticipated consequences, you know, going beyond what's obvious to say, well, wait a minute, you know, if this happens, then this might happen, this might happen, then this might happen. And that's really where this the gifted strategists figure out what's the most meaningful impact I could make to improve my situation, given the unique resources and capabilities of my firm.
Well said. The other thing that I wanted to get your perspective on was this whole debate about very large established companies and these young disruptive startups. How do these large companies manage their strategy when they are confronted with a young disruptive startup, which maybe in 1 year has a valuation greater than this 100-year-old company?
Well, it is a rich dilemma. What I think we need to understand is, well, first of all, at least in the United States, our competition agencies have just been on the sidelines for years. So what's happened is the large companies just buy the competition. You know, they just buy the small ones. And that's been the case across tech. It's certainly been the case in pharma, banking, you know, whatever. So they haven't really faced the brunt of competition from these little disruptive startups. Yeah. The second thing I think it's important to understand is that the basis on which market analysts value companies is quite different if you're, you know, a large established company with a lot of business versus a startup that might be opening up opportunities. And a way to think about this, not the only way, but a way to think about this is when investors are valuing small companies at these incredibly, inflated values, what they're really buying is option value. So they're making what to them is a small investment today that might lead to a super significant upside in return. Now, the reality is most of these small companies will die. I mean, most of them either will get acquired or they'll go out of business. And so the sort of freaking out of the larger organizations is sometimes, to me, not quite warranted, because if you think about it, big companies, I mean, they will cry poverty to you, but they're rich. They have loads of resources. If they want to spend them, they've got lots of talented people. They've often got patents. They've got strong situations. They've got established, mechanisms. So the biggest barrier to their being able to compete effectively with startups is usually internal.
That's true. And of course, the other thing that I've often said is that the large companies have profits as compared to valuations, huge
Exactly.
losses. So, Rita, two more questions relating to strategy, and then I want to move to your book. Next question is, how can companies balance short-term pressures with long-term strategic goals?
Well, that's one of the questions of our age. And I'm very fond of David Cote's observation. And so David was the CEO of Honeywell for 17 years. And he wrote a fabulous book called Winning Now, Winning Later, which tackles this exact question. And what he says is, the problem with the long term is eventually it becomes the short term.
Right.
And I think that's really a way you have to look at it. I think great CEOs do both. And if you think about it, the short-termism that we see really across much of the world's economy is driven by nothing more than the way that we account for things. Annual accounting, quarterly results, the whole sort of fabric of accountancy that we've evolved over many, many years, was born in a much more stable time. And it really doesn't take into account things that take time. I mean, yourself. A really profound innovation is probably a 3 to 5 year undertaking. It's not something that's going to happen in a 3 quarter time frame. And so I think part of what CEOs need to be able to do is paint the picture of, what's our 3 to 5 year horizon look like? What does that mean for the short term? And how should investors and other observers be looking at us? And so a great example of this would be Adobe when they decided to make the shift from selling shrink wrap box software to selling software that would be available on the cloud, in sort of a rental kind of basis. And what's fascinating to me is their CFO took a massively important role in this, as he would describe it. He said, "Oh, I spent 40 days and 40 nights on the road, talking to analysts, saying, here's the shift we're making, here's why we're doing it, here's how you can expect to see the numbers change, here's what we agree to be held accountable to." And in a fascinating example, their revenues went down during this transition as they sort of were shifting their resources. Their market capitalization went up. Isn't that fascinating?
Amazing.
So I think if you recognize that the pressures in many cases are simply artificial, and take that sort of more holistic view, and then bring your stakeholders along with you, I think it becomes much more straightforward to balance the short term and the long term. A company that's brilliant at this is Amazon. They will say, "We understand to build a billion-dollar business is a 3 to 5 year thing, and we're prepared to be that patient." And many of their huge successes have come out of that philosophy.
Great response. Thank you. One more question on strategy, and that is relating to ethics. And a lot of companies around the world are constantly, a lot of boardrooms are confronting ethics or ethical considerations when it comes to strategic decision making. I'd love to get your perspective.
Well, I think for well-run companies, a strong ethical, purpose-driven, mission-focused underpinning is really not optional. Eventually, if you have an ethical problem, I believe it eventually does catch up with you. And if you look at Enron and Arthur Andersen and some recent examples of companies that have been caught, dealing with very bad behavior, Wells Fargo here in the United States, eventually I think it catches up with you. The other thing that I would say about ethics is in a world which is so confusing and so complex, what we're seeing emerge now is this notion of purpose and this notion of a higher calling. And for your younger listeners, right, many of them will say, I would trade off, compensation, I would trade off certain benefits, I would trade off certain, other ways that I might be rewarded for working for your firm for a sense of purpose, for a sense of belonging to something bigger than I am, for something that I think will endure beyond whatever my momentary contribution is. So I think ethical challenges really interfere with that. It's a slippery slope, right? The minute you say, oh, well, just this once, right? What do you really stand for? I'm part of a study group, actually, with a gentleman who is the coach for the New Zealand All Blacks, the very famous rugby team. And he was talking about a situation which I found quite compelling. He said they were in the midst of a major challenge. They were up against very competent teams looking for a major goal, a major goal. And one of the team members violated a team norm. And he said, in many organizations, they would have all looked at me and said, what are you going to do about that? And he said, they didn't. The team collectively made the decision that this player was not going to be able to participate, even though this person was a superstar player, because they violated a team norm. And that in the long run, that was not a culture they wanted to embrace. They wanted to preserve this sort of collective team culture where they'd all agreed on what the goals were and what the behaviors were that they would endorse. And I thought that was a brilliant example of,
Absolutely.
how the team, properly motivated, can actually enforce ethical norms.
Very well said. Thank you. So I'm now going to move to your book, Rita. The book is titled Seeing Around Corners: How to Spot Inflection Points in Business Before They Happen. I'm going to ask all our viewers and listeners to go and check out Professor Rita McGrath's book. I will check it out and I will order a copy for myself. So my first question for you, Rita, is how do you define inflection points in business, and why are they crucial for leaders to understand them?
Well, I define an inflection point as a shift, typically in the external environment, although not always, that creates a 10x change in what's possible. So 10x faster, 10x cheaper, 10x more convenient, 10x different. And why they're important is that the typical organization develops a recipe for success over time. And over time, as a leader, as a manager, you learn if I push this button, this comes out. If I follow these KPIs, that's the result I will achieve. And in a predictable environment, you learn repetitively to operate, right? You rinse and repeat, you operate exactly, you operate with high quality. What an inflection point does is it changes that envelope of constraints and opportunities. And if you get it right, it can take your business to new heights. If you miss it or refuse to acknowledge it, it can cause your business to go into decline. So I think they're very, very important. Now, one of the more peculiar things about inflection points to me is they tend to have a life cycle, which is similar to Gartner's hype cycle. So in the very earliest stages, people see it and they go, ah, I mean, oh my God, ChatGPT, AI, and then before that it was crypto, and before that it was blockchain, and before that it was, autonomous vehicles. And so what happens is when these things first reveal themselves in terms of the possibilities that they might unleash, people tend to overreact. And they overreact, they spend way too much money, there's too much activity, and then people get disappointed because, as we were just talking about, these things don't have an impact immediately. They take, 3 to 5 years before you really realize what's going on. And so then a lot of people get disappointed. They abandon the area, they shut those projects down, they abandon the opportunities, they fire all the people that were involved. And then what you have is the few survivors left are the ones that now actually are able to take advantage. So the early days of the dot-com era would be a great example. We had all the flurry and all the fuss and this and that. We had pets.com and an AOL and all these firms. And then the dot-com came, the dot-com bubble burst, many, many firms just basically shut down their internet operations. But out of those early days, the survivors, Amazon, eBay, the direct-to-consumer companies, demonstrated that viable internet businesses were not just a flash in the pan, they were actually reality. And that was what laid the foundation for the internet economy as we know it.
Fabulous. The other question that I had was, when it comes to an inflection point, this could be noticed by anyone in the organization, no matter how senior or how junior. My question is, how important is organizational culture in recognizing and responding to inflection points?
Oh, it's huge. Oh, it's huge. You know, the companies that do this well have what I call ways of getting out to the edges. The phrase that I like to use is snow melts, but it melts from the edges. And so the most important data that you need as a senior leader doesn't come in a wrapped package arriving at corporate headquarters with a big neat announcement. You know, it's some guy on a loading dock who goes, "Hang on, I never noticed that competitor in this space before." Or a person talking to a customer on a service line saying, "Wait a minute, they're asking for something we've never thought to provide." So it's these weak signals that make themselves manifest at the edges. And culturally, as a leader, if you're in this very hierarchical situation where people don't talk to you, the senior leadership is all wrapped in bubble wrap, younger people aren't able to communicate, or the people that have the information aren't sort of invited into the strategic conversations, you're going to miss incredible amounts of really valuable information.
Well said. So, time for two more questions for you. My next question is that, given all the work that you did for this book, can you share with us a case or a case study where a company failed to recognize an inflection point, and what were the consequences?
Sure. So a great example of this would be the case of men's shaving and Gillette. So, you know, Gillette, which Procter and Gamble paid $57 billion for in 2005. I mean, it's hard to imagine a more iconic brand that's been more successful for longer than Gillette. I mean, 70% market share, incredible margins, the best a man can get. You know, and the business model was we invest in R&D that allows us to develop better products for which we can charge more. And then we use our hundreds of employees to get our products into the best retail establishments. And then kind of undergirding the whole thing is millions of dollars of brand building, primarily mass market advertising, right? And it was the best a man could get. And they cranked that machine over and over and over again for decades until, right, 2010 or so. And a young man named Mike Dubin, who's something of a failed entrepreneur, you know, improv actor, sort of looks at their whole model and he goes, "Well, this is ridiculous. Why do we do it this way? You know, we can buy everything on the internet. Why can't we buy razors?" And he found Dollar Shave Club. Pretty soon after that, Harry's, which is a similar direct consumer business, was founded. And within a few short years, Gillette's brand value for that brand went into precipitous decline. Now, they're still a great business. They're still like a 50% market share, but that's way down from 70%. And now, of course, they've responded now. You know, they've got their own direct consumer business. They've got their own technology. They've sort of come back, but they had to take a significant brand write-off. Now, I would be willing to bet you, I don't know this for a fact, no insider information, but I bet you the young people at Gillette were jumping up and down and saying, "Hey, e-commerce is here. You know, why do I have to go to, you know, Walgreens to buy my blades? Why can't you just send them to me? That's a much more sensible business model." But I would suspect the senior leadership wasn't inviting those conversations into the room.
What a great example. Thank you. And my last question to you, and I'm going to ask you to look at your crystal ball in this. Based on your research, what potential inflection points do you foresee in the near future for businesses?
Oh, there's so many. You know, a friend of mine is a futurist called Patrick Maron, and he said, "There are many more conceivable disasters than will ever actually happen," which I always really enjoy because the human imagination is just wild. So let's pick three that I think are worth thinking about. The first one is actually super interesting because it is based on demographics, which is that by 2030, McKinsey and others have estimated that there will be this enormous shift of who controls wealth in the world to women. And that's just demographics. Baby boomer men tended to marry women who were a little younger than they were, and women outlived men on average by 6 years. So just if you just look at logistics, all that money is going to transfer. And we know statistically, women make investment decisions, women make financial choices very differently than men do. So I think that's going to be a massive inflection point that's going to ripple across just every industry that we can think of. So that's one. Second thing is if we look at the delivery of public sector goods like healthcare, education, and so forth, I really think digital is going to fundamentally influence the way that those things are delivered. So if you just look at healthcare, and take pharmaceuticals, right? In the pharmaceutical industry, we think of the pill or the medication or the thing. Whereas if you have a combination of digital and those other things and sort of looking after the whole person, you could actually completely change the healthcare equation. And there's a company here in the US called CareBridge, which is actually doing that. What they're doing is taking the most ill patients, so the ones that are being looked after at home or being looked after in community settings, and they're actually surrounding them with 24/7 digital services. And their philosophy is, if I can catch you when you've first developed a cold, right, or when you first had a trip that's caused you to skin your knee, if I can catch you at that moment and avoid a subsequent hospitalization or wound care or something very expensive down the road, I can actually save on the total cost of your care over your life. And they're getting paid that way. So it's a fascinating example to me. So I think this infusion of digital into services like healthcare is going to be massive. And then I do think AI has the potential to upend a lot of different industries. So let's just media as an example. Where we saw digital first affect the media businesses, and I'll call like what we're doing is media, TV is media, radio is media, you know. But where it really started to show up as a big deal was in distribution. That was the initial issue. And what you saw was advertising, for example, moving from traditional print to search markets and other markets. Where we're going to see the next big inflection point there, to me, is in the production side of things. So, you know, when a 12-year-old can push a button on an AI engine and produce 90-second video that's every bit as good as what a Hollywood studio could produce, you know, the changes are going to be massive. And so I think those are three that I would
Amazing.
say are pretty
Amazing.
substantial.
Amazing. And on that note, Rita, and your three amazing perspectives, 2030 wealth will be controlled by a large part of wealth will be controlled by women. And I think that'll be a fantastic thing. My wife is a much better investor than I am. Second, you said was digital will be, you know, a big game changer for businesses or health industries like healthcare. And the third one, you spoke about artificial intelligence and how it's going to change the way we think, not just for people who are of a certain age, but for people who are very, very young. Thank you, Rita, for talking to me about your journey. Thank you for talking to me about strategy at such length. Thank you also for speaking to me about your book and inflection points. Thank you again and good luck.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.